We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. This year, this program, Focus, turned 30, and we have been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. These are shows that feature some of our most interesting guests and touch on topics that we think are as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. And in this installment of what we have been calling the Deep Archives Project, we have two interviews that explore the relationship between the United States and Japan. Today, China heads up the list of our economic competitors in East Asia, but back in the 1980s, that spot was occupied by Japan. People even talked of this competition as war by other means, casting it as a kind of extension of the war the two nations had fought in the Pacific. In 1987, we talked about the unique character of that war and its continuing influence on U.S.-Japan relations with historian John Dower. In his book, War Without Mercy, he argued that, unlike the European War, the Pacific War was a race war in which longstanding racist thinking fueled the fighting. He says that it is fortunate that both sides were able to put this terrible conflict behind them, but he goes on to say that it is dangerous to forget how easily the war came about and how fierce the fighting was.
Well, what I did in the book, I got into this study somewhat by chance. I was beginning to write a book on post-war Japan, namely Japan after World War II, and in trying to wrestle with the occupation of Japan and how you could move from war to peace so quickly and to good relations so quickly, I just had to go back to the war. And when you get back there, I found a really pervasive strain or pervasive strains of contempt for the Japanese or of racial filtering of ideas concerning the Japanese, which had repercussions in many ways. It affected intelligence gathering. It affected policy making. It affected many, many aspects of the war. And it's a funny kind of a view. One of the things that's quite stunning in retrospect to go back is to see how contemptuous both British and Americans were of the Japanese before Pearl Harbor, and the whole story everywhere. You pick this up everywhere. Japanese can't shoot, they can't fight, they can't sail, they can't fly airplanes, they can't think imaginatively, they'd never do anything truly daring. They'd be easily cowed by Westerners, so we can just jerk the noose and they'll fall into line with economic pressures or something of that sort. So that there's and they back this up with a lot of rational reasons why they're inferior. They don't think imaginatively because they have to memorize all those ideographs, and they can't fly airplanes because they have inner ear imbalance, and they've never done anything technologically innovative, so we don't have to worry about them beating us technologically. And when Pearl Harbor came, suddenly they appear and with the Zero aircraft, which is the best aircraft, and they've been flying it for a year. We just didn't bother to study the reports of it in China. They appear at the Zero, which is the best fighter plane in the world at that time. They fly superbly. They fly at night, which we said they couldn't do because they were night blind. They pulled an extraordinarily daring plan, namely to attack Pearl Harbor, which we said was not part of what they could do. They did it in ships, of course, which we said they couldn't build or sail well. And we were astonished. We couldn't believe it. The first responses from the war, when the Japanese hit the Philippines, MacArthur said, well, it must be German pilots flying the Japanese planes. That was his response. And I thought that was MacArthur-esque. And you go into the reports in Hong Kong, the first response of the British when the Japanese came over Hong Kong was, must be German mercenaries flying the Japanese planes. They couldn't do it. Well, once they had done it, then we went back to another image of Orientals that we often have, and that is that they're supermen. They've got some special power. So it's quite a mix of images that we deal with.
Yeah. I think overall, if you look at a lot of the material that you researched, the things that go all the way from cartoons to government documents, on both sides there was a concerted effort to dehumanize the enemy, to make them less than human.
One of the things that I really want to stress is that the book is a comparative study, and I see racism and racial thinking as a very important part of the way people think. And half of my book is about Japanese doing the same thing to other people, both Anglo-Americans and Japanese, and it's the comparative aspect that interests me. The dehumanization aspect is interesting, and it's interesting to us today, not just for World War II, because if you turn the enemy into something less than human, it also follows rather naturally that then you exterminate the enemy. And the way we did that, the way our exterminationist rhetoric emerged, was to turn the Japanese into the most dominant image was apes, monkey men and apes, but also vermin, of course, the Nazi phrase for the Jews. And then you just have a whole kind of rhetoric. In Iwo Jima, the Marines went into battle with rodent exterminator stenciled on there. On the helmets. I think this is natural. I think if I were a fighting man in a fighting situation, I would not want to say I may be killing a man like myself with a wife or a fiancé or children at home. I mean, you have to dehumanize, but then it becomes a larger policy and it penetrates back to the ruling people who would just say, we got to exterminate those beasts. On the Japanese side, the Japanese did not go back to the animal imagery. They went back to devils and demons, and that by far the standard phrase and the standard image in cartoons is of Westerners as demons. And so their phrase is, we've got to kill the Anglo-American devils, kill the demonic Anglo-Americans. And well, we're talking about their atrocities, and they're talking about our atrocities to their people, and we point out real things that they do that are bestial, and they point out things to their people that seem demonic, like bombing cities and occasionally bombing Red Cloak, hospital ships and so on. So then they start to back it up. But then the exterminationist side of this is terrifying.
Mm-hmm. There is a sense where very quickly this kind of thinking picks up momentum and accelerates and very rapidly gets. It seems that it can rapidly get to the point that it can't be controlled and it takes on a life of its own.
Well, one of the I never would say race was the cause of the war or the main thing in the war. I think wars pick up a momentum of their own, but when race or dehumanization then enters into the picture, it just compounds what's going on. One of the things that I think we still have to wrestle with in World War II in Asia, which applies to the future as well, is it was pretty easy to get into that war. I mean, that was pretty easy. You can just get into it. The Japanese got into it without really thinking how to get out of it. And of course, once it happened, you're in it. And then it's very hard to end. So that by 1944, it's very clear. I mean, it's clear to everyone that the Japanese can't win. No one. It's unthinkable that the Japanese can win the war by 1944. Yet the greatest killing of Allied soldiers, I mean, the greatest number of deaths of Allied soldiers, American soldiers, and in particular, the greatest number of deaths on the Japanese side, and of course the bombing of the Japanese cities and the things that happen elsewhere in Asia, the greatest number of deaths happen after it's clear that Japan has lost in the end. So then you get into the question of why can't you pull out, and you get into a cycle of both blood debts and hatred and racial, how can we surrender to this bestial enemy, or how can we let this, this bestial enemy must be destroyed in the case of us looking at the Japanese, or Japanese saying, how can we surrender to these demons, they will come in and annihilate us. And so you can't get out of the war.
I wonder if you might give some more examples about some of the ways that that the images and the stereotyping were operating at the time. And in one point of your book, you list several ways in which each side did the same thing, did a similar activity. And for example, that if you look at the images, each side created the images it created of the other, the enemy, you can see that each side portrays the other as its opposite.
There's two things we can do here. One is there are real patterns in the way Anglo-Americans look to Japanese and other non-white peoples, and there are real patterns in the way Japanese look at the rest of the world. And then this very curious thing you mentioned, where one person's self-congratulatory images become the other person's derogatory image. And the classic case is the Americans and Westerners to the Japanese at the beginning of the war. And this was their great miscalculation. They looked at the West and they said, what is the West? The West stresses individualism. The West is a place it's egoistic, it's materialistic. People are only most concerned with the individual. It's selfish. They're degenerate. They'll never be able to pull together. Therefore, if we attack the United States, they don't have the wherewithal to pull together for a higher cause and to fight a long battle. That was their... And then they attacked Pearl Harbor, which, of course, will indeed live in infamy forever, and mobilizes people, pulls them out of isolationism in America like nothing possibly could have done. They missed that. So what is individualism to us, to them is decadence, egoism, selfishness. The Japanese say... We emphasize the group. We work for the society. We emphasize the larger collectivity. And we look at that and say, look at these people. They're totally devoid of individuality. The famous phrase from the war, regarded as probably the most racist phrase from the war, appears in the U.S. Army film called Know Your Enemy Japan, directed by Frank Capra. And it says, the Japanese are all prints off the same photographic negative. Japanese are all printed. You've seen one Japanese, you've seen them all. But the Japanese ruling groups who are indoctrinating their people at this time have all sorts of slogans like 100 million hearts beating is one. Even the Japanese militarists even say 100 million is one bullet. So they themselves, you know, are saying this solidarity, and we're turning it into a very negative type of thing. Another thing that would happen, and this can be turned in different ways, the old notion. It came up just recently, and Morita, the founder of Sony, published his biography and autobiography, and mentioned that he thought he had an Oriental sixth sense. You know, this Oriental intuition. Well, now that's kind of popular. People study Zen and do things like that. But when when they stressed intuition. As a virtue, you know, you feel it in your gut, you know instinctively what to do. At that time, we say they're irrational. These are irrational people. So what is to them a positive thing, that they have something beyond rationality, we turn into a negative thing. So in many ways, we turn people's, what they see as their positive virtues, and we just turn them around and use them as completely negative stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And of course, we romanticize ourselves. We romanticize our individualism, and they romanticize their solidarity.
Let me go on here. We got about 10 minutes left in the program. I have another caller that I would like to get to, and we will do that. We'll move right on over to the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, Dave.
Hi.
I assume that the professor is probably in his late 40s or early 50s.
Very good.
Well, I was about 5 years old in 1941, and I can remember the tremendous fear, even sort of hysteria. I mean, I was, of course, living here in the Midwest here, but I can remember after Pearl Harbor was smashed with such a heavy air attack that people were afraid there might be an invasion of the West Coast. And we've traveled from that time, 1942, those conceptions of Pearl Harbor attack in 41, to now we have Japanese-owned auto plants here in Illinois. You know, we've gone a long way, and it seems that even though Japanese were sort of dehumanized in our propaganda, World War II, after we defeated them, then we tried to remake them in our own image, Professor.
We have indeed come a long way since then, and I think... things are tense now, but we can be extremely happy that you can turn things around in this way. And I think that there was a certain type of American idealism at the end of the war, which I find admirable, that there was a kind of a notion that you could rebuild Japan, and that there were elements of generosity which are to be applauded. I don't think there was philanthropy, and I don't think that that America works in, as a philanthropic country. We didn't rebuild Japan because we thought it was nice and they were nice people and we were good guys. We rebuilt them because we thought it was necessary to the global capitalist economy and to the fight against communism. And the decisions can be documented very clearly. We didn't... I'm not saying we are people of ill will, but I'm not saying we're people who run around doing philanthropy. It was a hard decision, and it was a notion that Japan was essential to... We immediately had new enemies. The new demons, the new monsters were now communists. Japan, we just turned them into an ally very quickly. We had to get them self-sufficient. We had to build them up economically. And it's even more complicated when, if you go in actually to why we built up Japan, why we helped Japan build up at the end of the war, it's because we had decided to cut off China from the rest of the world. And we were afraid that if we contained China economically, isolated China economically, we hoped that would cause China to collapse, Japan would have nowhere to turn and Southeast Asia would have nowhere to turn, and we could integrate Japan and Southeast Asia. Those economies would come up, and it was essential to our vision of a global international economy.
I really want to get in a question, again, looking at the current trade friction between the two countries. Given the fact that you've done the work that you have, when you look at the rhetoric that is now flying about on the topic of trade, does that concern you?
Yes, it concerns me very much. It concerns me coming from both directions. We're not in a situation like the 1930s. That is to say, Japan is not about to become an independent military power and attack the United States. That's inconceivable. I do think we're in a situation economically that is extraordinarily chaotic, and that the key actors in this are U.S. and Japan and the European Economic Community. And as tensions rise, racial issues and rhetoric is coming in now that is very familiar to me, having done a book on World War II. And it's coming in from the Japanese side with all of this, I think, offensive to most non-Japanese rhetoric about being a pure race, being a homogeneous race, having some cultural superiority. It's an arrogance of power that is not peculiar to the Japanese, but now that they're powerful, we see it. The Americans are coming up with all sorts of stuff. Maybe we should go over to Japan in a B-52 on our next trade mission. World War II hasn't been ended. We're still fighting World War II. And then a lot of outright racist things. And we must remember that we know what the Japanese are saying from our media. They know what we're saying. So trade delegations from Congress going over saying we've got to deal with the little yellow men. That gets reported in the Japanese press. I mean, and this makes it much harder for both sides to resolve what is really an economic crisis that is serious. So it's not that race causes the problems, but this type of thinking makes it so much more difficult for those who are people of goodwill and really want to work for solution to work, because the emotions, the visceral dimensions begin to impede resolution of the problems.
That's John Dower. He was a guest on this program. Back then we called it Focus 580 in April of 1987, and we were talking about his book, War Without Mercy, Race and Power in the Pacific War. That book won the National Book Critics Circle Award for General Nonfiction in 1986. And currently, John Dower is Ford International Professor of History at MIT. This year, our program turned 30, and to celebrate that fact, we dug into our tape collection looking for some interesting people with things to say about important subjects. And these are programs that mostly are not part of our web archive, and in most cases, these are shows that have not been heard since they were first broadcast. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project, and you can tell us what you think in a couple of ways. You can go to the Focus section of our webpage. look near the top. You'll find a place that you can leave a comment, or you can write to us at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois, and our zip code is 61801. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
The new documentary, Magic Trip, features previously unreleased footage shot during the Mary Prankster's psychedelic bus trip across America in 1964. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Ken Kesey, one of the organizers of the trip, writer Robert Stone, who met up with the Pranksters in New York, and Tom Wolfe, who documented the trip in his book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This year, our program turned 30, and as we thought about what we might do to celebrate the anniversary, we realized that we had a lot of programs in storage. They were recorded on cassettes. They're not part of our regular web archive, and these are shows that have not been aired. Most of them have not been aired since the very first time that they were aired. So we went back looking for interesting people and interesting subjects that we could repeat. Things that we thought certainly would bear at least one more listening. And over the years on the program, we've had many University of Illinois faculty as guests, and we were saddened recently to hear of the death of one of them, David Goodman. He was professor of Japanese literature and theater here at University of Illinois. He had written widely on both subjects in both English and Japanese. And back in March of 1989, he was on the program. We talked about another of his interests, and that is anti-Semitism in modern Japan, something that he believed reflected the way many Japanese saw the United States and had serious implications for the relationship between the two countries.
The first thing that has to be said is that this phenomenon is essentially restricted to literature. It is restricted to the realm of ideas. There isn't an active Japanese anti-Semitic movement, nor is there any political party or politically active group that makes anti-Semitism one of its cardinal principles. On the other hand, it's interesting that there's been a, over the years, there's been a rather consistent interest on the part of the Japanese with the Jews. There's one bibliography of Japanese writing on the Jews that goes from about from the 1870s through the 1970s, and that bibliography runs to more than 120 pages. Hmm. I mean, just page after page after page. Every year, books, articles are written on the subject of the Jews, and there has been, for more than 100 years, this fascination on the part of the Japanese with the Jews. Now, there are reasons for that, and the nature of the interest has changed depending on the historical period that we're talking about. But as you said, what has raised a lot of eyebrows in this country was the it began with an article in the New York Times in March 1987, which revealed the fact that there were best-selling books in Japan that were overtly anti-Semitic in character and promoting some of the most vicious and awful traditional kinds of slander about the Jews, things that we in this country generally thought went out with the Nazis. Mm-hmm. In Japan, these books have sold hundreds of thousands and even millions of copies, and so that's a cause of some concern.
Well, let's go on and talk some more about just what the nature of the problem is, because it seems that as you think about it, on the face of it, it looks like one thing, and perhaps at its root, it's something different. And it's interesting that you say that sometimes when you talk about this, people say, well, you know, if you didn't go around talking about it all the time, it would go away, as if to say that you're exaggerating the significance of it. What does really seem to be going on, and what is it really about?
Well, that's the problem. That's the core of the problem, is how to interpret this phenomenon. I mean, the fact is that one author, a man named Uno, has sold by this time somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million copies of his virulently anti-Semitic books, in which he says that the Holocaust. He denies that the Holocaust happened. At the same time, he suggests that he acknowledges that large numbers of Jews were murdered by Hitler and also by Stalin. But then he goes on to say, "But this was only in self-defense, and it was necessary because the diabolical international Jewish conspiracy to take over the world was threatening Germany and also the Soviet Union, and that Hitler was only acting in self-defense to defend the German folk." And then he goes on to say that that Japan is in the same situation as Germany was before the war, engaged in a life and death struggle with this diabolical Jewish menace. He says that what U.S.-Japan trade friction is in fact the struggle of Japanese culture, the Japanese folk. He uses a term that I translate, the closest translation that I can come up with is the German word folk with a V. That he suggests that the Japanese take a lesson from Hitler as to how to deal with this, because it's the same situation. Now, the interesting thing that Uno does and others of these people do is to identify the United States as a Jewish country, and they say that that the United States is a Jewish country, that it's controlled by a Jewish shadow government. This Jewish shadow government is controlled by four famous Jewish families, the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Mellons, and the Carnegies. Now, of course, none of these are in, have, it would come as a surprise to all of those families that they were Jewish. But according to Mr. Uno, they are, and they control the United States. And so the United States is in fact a Jewish country. And so the relationship between Japan and the United States is in fact a relationship between Japan and the Jews, and trade friction between Japan and the United States is actually a confrontation between Japan and the international Jewish conspiracy. Well, you know, I can go on and on with this kind of theorizing. But I think that this idea that the United States is somehow a Jewish country and therefore U.S.-Japan relations are invalid is really the key to understanding what is happening and what's being said. I think that the point that Mr. Uno would like to make, and with what the others of these right-wing anti-Semites would like to make, is that there is something fundamentally illegitimate about the U.S.-Japan relationship, and they want to discredit that relationship, if at all possible. At the same time, they want to discredit and label as illegitimate liberal, democratic institutions within Japan. So, for example, Mr. Uno argues, both in his books and publicly in public forums, that the post-war constitution, which was essentially designed by the United States and presented as a fait accompli to the Japanese, is the product of a Jewish conspiracy. And, of course, the point of the Jewish conspiracy is to take over the world. And therefore, the post-war constitution, which is the document that mandates post-war Japanese democracy, is also illegitimate because it's the product of this plot, this conspiracy, which the ultimate purpose of which is to destroy Japan. So the logic goes that since the United States is a Jewish country, and since U.S.-Japan relations are in fact Jewish-Japanese relations, that post-war Japanese democracy, which has been influenced by the United States and by Japan's relationship with the United States, is also illegitimate. And so this provides the basis, the ideological basis, for all kinds of revisionist kinds of thinking in Japan. And that's the point where I think the relationship between the United States and Japan comes into play in this. I want to be very careful. As you said earlier, people have suggested that I'm blowing the problem out of proportion, and that if I would only shut up and stop talking about it, it would go away. And I want to be very careful not to do that. It's not my intention to suggest that that the Japanese are profoundly and irremediably anti-Semitic, that there is some kind of a widespread anti-Semitic movement in Japan. That is not the case. But the fact that books that are indistinguishable from Nazism are selling in the millions and millions of copies, that they are being read avidly by Japanese readers, is a phenomenon that I think ought to be explained.
Let's talk with a caller right here on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
At the outset, I'd like to say that I think it is a significant problem. And I was wondering if the guest could address the extent that we know where this negative phenomenon is taking place in the socioeconomic spectrum in Japan. Like, is this the ruling elite that feels this way and is buying these books? And is it now intellectually legitimate for them to be talking as if there wasn't a Holocaust? Or to what extent is that focused in their society?
I think that's a very perceptive question. The I think we have to talk about two groups and two aspects of this problem. I think, first of all, that the phenomenon of anti-Semitism in Japan is partly the result of a deep-seated malaise and anxiety on the part of the Japanese middle class, the white-collared salaried worker who rides an hour or 2 hours each way to work every day. And the books that we're talking about are essentially books that are called business books in Japan. They're books that are edited and aimed at Japanese business people. I think that this particular group of people, the middle class, middle managers of Japanese companies, have a sense that they're being cheated by forces that they don't quite understand, and they're looking for simple explanations and scapegoats to try to explain what's happening. There have been some rather rapid changes in Japan's economic status in the last few years, particularly with the very rapid appreciation of the yen. And this threatened Japanese well-being. People became very, very anxious about what was happening. And they were looking for some kind of simple explanation to explain. And, of course, the simplest explanation is, well, that there's a conspiracy going on. There's somebody behind the scenes manipulating the world economy. And that is what Mr. Uno and other people like him were prepared to say. At the same time, I think there is a more widespread problem, and I would hesitate to call this anti-Semitism, but there are widespread stereotypes of the Jews in Japan, and these stereotypes are presented to the Japanese on a daily basis in the mass media. For example, there was a major article in the business section of the Yomiuri newspaper, the Japanese newspaper, which is the largest circulating daily in Japan, has a circulation of somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 million copies every day nationwide. On January 17th of 1987, the paper ran a major article in which it treated the theories of Uno Masami, the author that I've been describing, as a credible explanation for the world economy and the behavior of the world economy. The article claimed that middle and even upper management in the Bank of Japan were sympathetic with Uno's theories and thought that there was probably something to them, that after all, the Jews really do run the United States and most of the rest of the world, and so there probably is something to Uno's theories. So when a major newspaper like the Yomiuri treats ideas like Mr. Uno's as credible, that presents a problem. And, of course, what is the average Japanese who doesn't know, you know, who believes what he reads in the newspaper to think? If I were a Japanese man on the street, I would believe that Mr. Uno, if the people in the Bank of Japan said what he was saying is credible, and the Yomiuri thought it was credible, then I would think I would think it would be credible also. These images of the Jew as the miser, the idea that there is such a thing as international Jewish capital, that there is some kind of international Jewish conspiracy going on, is also presented on television. I can give you the example of a broadcast in December 1987, which was a program about, it's an ongoing series of programs about the Japanese economy. And in this particular program, the machinations of an international Jewish capitalist were described for 30 minutes. Now, the most objectionable thing is the idea that these people exist. But in addition, it showed scenes. This was an animated version of Japanese economic history. and the animators showed President Reagan in the Oval Office of the White House talking about international Jewish capital as if it were something that existed and needed to be dealt with. The program also depicted Judaism, the Jewish religion, as essentially a belief in sunspots and the prophecies of Nostradamus, which also is, I think, unfortunate and, of course, inaccurate. The book from which this was taken was published by the Nihon Keizai Shimbun, which is the Japanese equivalent of the Wall Street Journal. And if you have a book and a television program based on a book published by the Wall Street Journal or the Japanese equivalent thereof, again, the natural conclusion is, well, it must be so. There really must be such international Jewish capitalists who are going around manipulating the world economy. There really must be conversations going on in the Oval Office where the president says we have to do something about international Jewish capital and so forth. And Judaism really must be a belief in sunspots and the prophecies of Nostradamus. I mean, what else could one think? So I think that these kinds of broad spectrum kinds of the exposure of the Japanese people to these kinds of stereotypes is very problematical. Let me give you just one final example, and that is the way the word Jew is defined in Japanese reference works. In the fourth edition of the New Crown English-Japanese Dictionary, the definition of Jew reads as follows. Jew, noun. Jews covet money very much. Since there are many Jewish millionaires, the following are representative of Jews. Avaricious, a miser, rich, etc. Be rich as a Jew, to have a lot of money, just like the Jews. He's a perfect Jew. He's typically Jewish. That is extremely miserly. I mean, if you look up in your, you know, you want to see what a Jew is, and you look up in your dictionary to find out, you find, oh, I see, it's a Shylock, a miser. So just to sum up what I've said, I think there are two aspects to this problem. One is the kind of active, virulent anti-Semitism based on Nazism and on ancient forgeries like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion that Mr. Uno is promoting. It's appealing basically to the middle class businessman. At the same time, there is this problem of stereotyping, which is not attributable to any individual or any movement, but rather to just a general misunderstanding and ignorance within Japanese society that is very unfortunate. The reason that I stress this difference is I think that it when we try to say, well, what if anything do we need to do about it? It affects the kind of strategy that we in the United States or that the organized Jewish community might want to take. I don't think that the Japanese people are malicious, are intentionally trying to do anything vis-a-vis the blacks and the Japanese and the Jews. I think that what we need to do is to engage them in a dialogue and say, look, we know you didn't mean it, but the fact of the matter is that what you've been saying, whether it's about blacks or about Jews, is very, very offensive to us, and we can't have a good, healthy relationship with you if you continue to believe these things, to say them, to present these images in your mass media and your department stores or wherever. So I think that we have to try to develop constructive strategies to deal with what is a very distasteful problem.
And you think that it would be appropriate and constructive for that kind of thing to happen at the government level? That's where that should happen?
Well, I think that it's not inappropriate. For example, last summer there was a very, very strenuous protest by the Congressional Black Caucus about these mannequins and the little Beck Sambo dolls and so forth. I don't think that's inappropriate, but I don't necessarily think that a government-to-government kind of dialogue is going to address the problem. I think what we need is a people-to-people kind of an approach where we devise ways to try to address the Japanese people. And I'm glad to report that both black organizations and Jewish organizations have been developing sort of exchange programs and other sorts of strategies that can address precisely these kinds of issues on a people-to-people basis, on a people-to-people level.
That's David Goodman. He was talking about anti-Semitism in modern Japan on our program, Focus 580, in March of 1989. He went on to write a book on the subject titled Jews in the Japanese Mind, The History and Uses of a Cultural Stereotype. He was professor of Japanese literature and theater at the University of Illinois. He passed away on July 25th. This year, our program turned 30, and we have been doing shows like this, going back to the beginning of the year as a way of celebrating 30 years on the air, digging into our collection of tapes. These were programs that were recorded on cassette and then were packed away in boxes and haven't been heard. Most of them haven't been heard since. We are working on getting some of them onto our website. And in fact, this program is on the website. If you'd like to hear the complete interview, you can go to WILL.illinois.edu. We'll continue to do these. We're doing them every couple of weeks, and we're certainly interested in what you think about this project, about our program. You can make a comment either way, in a couple of ways. You can go to the focus section of our webpage, WILL.illinois.edu, and if you look near the top, you can find a place there that you can leave a comment. If you'd like to write to us, you can do that as well. We are at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois, and our zip code is 61801.